Unfiltered, the official Sunderland AFC podcast.
Hello and welcome to another edition of SAFC Unfiltered. I'm currently standing outside the huge square block of the Foundation of Lights building, the Beacon of Light. I'm going to go inside and speak to Sir Bob Murray, former chairman of Sunderland Football Club, who this week has released a book about his life, which of course includes a lot about his time at Sunderland Football Club. Danny's not here. He's away on international duty this week. It's a very grey day here in Sunderland, but there's always a warm welcome as I walk over the bridge up to the sliding double doors of the Beacon of Light. It's fair to say that Sir Bob has had an interesting life to date. It's going to be really interesting to hear some of those stories from Sir Bob in person. And just a reminder that all the proceeds from the sale of the book go directly to the Foundation of Light. Welcome to SAFC Unfiltered, Sir Bob Murray. Sir Bob, how are you?
I'm very good, Frankie. You?
I'm well. You've had a busy week of promoting this book. Have you enjoyed how busy you've been?
Well, I've never done a book before, Frankie, so it's been unique. We've been to London and we've been to Yorkshire and we're now in Sunderland all week promoting it.
Yeah.
Fantastic interest in the book. Has been very encouraging.
How does it differ being a businessman and a man who's essentially trying to sell a book? You've got a busy day still full of diary appointments, but I guess it's nice that you get to speak about your life.
Yeah, it is. The book's been a long journey. A lot of people have been asking me to do a book for a lot of reasons, really. I've had a colourful life. I've had an inspirational life as well. Highs and lows, and in 2018 we actually started. We got a great guy called Lance Hardy, who's very well known among Sunderland supporters. He was edited the match of the day and produced the match of the day. Very eminent man. Did Stoke 73, a lot of books. And Leslie Callaghan introduced me to Lance, and we appointed him to write the book. And then we went through a period of work. Meeting all over the country, putting a lot of effort and time in. Obviously, Lance was a Sunderland guy, not from Sunderland, but a Sunderland fanatic, and that made it a lot easier to cover the Sunderland angles off. He wasn't a businessman, so that was a bit tougher. But and then we had a really bad time. COVID came, and Lance had a brain tumour, and he stopped working. And died 6 months later. So it's been a tremendous journey for that. When you talk, we're doing a book, you talk about all kinds of things. You're very close. It's intimate. Very, very personal. And I loved the guy and became very, very friendly. So he died. And obviously, Frankie, we didn't continue then. We had a period of stoppage. And then we decided to make the editor the writer and carried on. So Lance had finished the book. It's a massive book. It's 400 pages, small typeset, 150,000 words. And as you know, every penny of the book, all £20, goes to the Foundation of Light. And that's the other driver for the book, because this year is the fifth year of the Foundation of Light, and we'd like to make a surplus this year for the first time, because we've been COVID and whatever since we opened the Beacon. And it's important to us to make a profit this year, a surplus. And so, obviously, we'd like to raise a six-figure sum for the foundation. And Henry Winter and all these people are raving about the book. So, fingers crossed.
Yeah, I mean, Lance has a good track record of making great books, hasn't he? And he's very well respected. Yeah. And when he passed, the likes of Gary Lineker, people like that were coming out and give tributes to Lance Hardy and his work. What is the process like when writing a book then, Sir Bob? Do you literally sit down with someone like Lance and does he say, tell us about your first match, tell us about when you first took over Sunderland, tell us about what happened on that day? How does it work?
Well, we've worked the book from like when I was born. We haven't jumped into the Premier League, how the Premier League happened as the first page. So it's been like, not always datal, but most of it. So we've done that. And before Lance past, we had the first book in very rough draft because his illness did interfere with his work. So all these chapters, Lance's names for the chapters, and there's over 40 chapters, and they fit in very nicely. So it's frankly a clean piece of paper. He doesn't have anything to go on. It's the first meeting. Was sat down with a tape, and I think he's got about 180 tapes.
And then he would just transcribe it from the tapes?
He'd do the work.
Wow, that's impressive.
It's been an experience because I've never been in literature before, and I've come across really nice people. It's quite unique that they don't do it for money. It's not like going to see a lawyer. It's really nice. It's like a love. It's a passion.
Yeah.
It's been a really nice experience. We even had a great lawyer check it. He did it for nothing because of the charity, and we've had an editor, a publisher. It's been a real journey.
Yeah, and were you ever approached earlier in life to write a book? Because I'd imagine you saw some of your peers like Sir Alex and other famous chairmen making books and selling books. Yeah. Had you ever been approached before?
No, I think, it's not for money. It's like a legacy issue. Obviously, the charity money's vital, but it's been nice because a lot of people say it's a shame you lost your life. It'd be a shame because, I had a council house upbringing, which I'm extremely proud of. Family had no money. We're in a two up, two down. And I left school and I was unemployed for a year, And that's the story. So it's quite inspirational as well.
Yeah, absolutely. And it makes perfect, the way it's written as well, with the backdrop of Sunderland Football Club and its ups and downs as well. It's really cleverly wrote, isn't it? Yeah. And we'll touch upon that as well as we discuss it. But I want to ask you, because this is for the fans of Sunderland Football Club, about that first game. And I know you do mention it in the book because I've read the book, but tell us, paint a picture of your first game at Roker Park. 1954, was it?
Yeah, the mid-50s.
Tell us about it, because you didn't live in Sunderland. You mentioned you lived in Consett, didn't you?
That's right, yeah.
So that's like, Durham way, isn't it?
Yeah, it's about 25 miles away. But my dad was a Sunderland coal miner. He was Silksworth Pit. He went down at 14. He didn't like being under the ground. So he moved to Consett to get a work job at the steelworks. My mum's from Hortonley Spring. So I was the only one born in Consett. So obviously when I was old enough to go to the game, my dad took me. And that happened to be when I was 9. It was the mid-50s, and we were playing Wolves at the time, and Wolves were the team at the top of the league with the great Billy Wright. And I went in the ground, and there's 50,000 faces there from a lad from the back streets of Consett. And that's something you'll never forget.
What can you remember about that day? What were the things that really struck you about being in Roker Park? What could you smell? What could you see?
I could smell the cigarettes.
Yeah.
And I could smell the beer.
Yeah.
And it was a very male crowd.
Yeah.
A very adult crowd. But it was just the faces. My dad made a step, hung it over the railings, and so I could stand on it and see over the camber at Roker, So, it's crikey. It was just all consuming.
Would you say that you fell in love on that day?
Oh, yeah. I was always going to be a Sunderland supporter. My dad had decided that. So it was a really great baptism. The score was 0-0. I thought they would win. But that was the day I first saw my first game.
And that started a love affair, I guess, with the club. And did you have any favourite players at that particular point?
My dad loves Len Shackleton. He loved Len Shackleton. And I later met Len, who's a very eminent man. And he did a second book. He's very famous for his first book when he had a page with nothing in, and that's what football directors knew about football. And he was a writer in the press. And Michael Parkinson let him down doing the foreword for a second book. And I was chairman of Sunderland at the time, and I had that honour. So, my dad that day to see Shackleton, who was my dad's favourite player, and then to think that his son would knock the ground down.
Yeah. And one of the players you mention in the book that you were a big fan of when you watched Sunderland was Brian Clough.
Yeah.
Was he the best Sunderland player you ever saw? And just how good was he?
Well, obviously, Charlie Hurley was the one that I've personally thought because of his loyalty. I think Charlie could have played for any team in Britain. He was that good. but he used to get on the bus with the fans from Ryab. So one of the first things I did when I became chairman, I befriended Charlie and his wife, Joan, and I invite them to Sunderland with their daughters, and the daughters couldn't believe the respect the crowd had for the dad. And he's a very, very nice gentleman. And we still have Christmas cards today. He's not in the best of health, but we still have Christmas cards. Brian Clough, I met. I idolised Brian Clough. I was there the day he finished. And I asked the chairman of Notts Forest if I could meet Brian. And so he invited me down to a cricket game at Nottingham in June one year. And he took me into the Forest ground to meet Brian. And it's June, remember, Frankie. And I went in and the office stunk of whiskey. It's in the morning, you know. And he says to me, he says, "You were young." He says, "I've heard all about you, you know." And then so when Brian finished, we invited him to Sunderland. And he's charming, charismatic, and very entertaining with the ladies. But he'd sit, you know, he's finished really. But he'd sit next to me, four rows back from the front, and he'd shout to Peter Reid, "Change it, change it." You know, all these great people, you know, Shackleton, Hurley, Clough, I had the great fortune to meet through being chairman of the club.
Yeah, there's a few themes in the book as well where your life seems to go full circle as being idolising someone, and then you become peers with
them.
That's
very astute.
And one of those people set the background, particularly in the 60s, was Alan Price, you know, and you were a fan of the Animals and you got into your music in the 60s as well.
First record was Don't Let Me Be Misunderstood by the Animals.
Yeah.
And we had the big charity day with Durham Cathedral.
You did.
Last year, and Alan came free of charge and played there. My life's been like that. Everything's come round in circles, you know? It comes round in circles. It starts with something and it hits me later.
Do you think you subconsciously have some kind of drive to make that happen then? Because all these moments were happening in your younger life, watching these players on the pitch and then becoming friends with them.
Yeah, my dad and mum bought me a bike at Millbrook and Sunderland second-hand shop for 12 quid and I had to cycle at the concert. 20-odd years later, I'm sat at Millbrook and Tom Cowie's office, a couple of yards from the second-hand shop. I tell you, would I have thought that? You know, the whole thing, you know, running the first Great North Run, yet Brendan Foster's a big friend of mine.
Yeah.
Or Saturday I'm out with Crammy. Yeah. You know, like it's just come back to us, Frank. I don't know why. It's like a boomerang.
Yeah. It's great. Obviously, a very successful businessman, which got you into the position where you are now. We're going to touch upon it a little bit now. I loved the stories of the perspex baths and ultimately moving on to the kitchen business as well. And then you speak about, the money started to come in and you were able to buy your first Porsche and a Mercedes and things like that. And was it ever at the back of your mind during that period when you were starting to accumulate a little bit of money that you would once own a football club?
No.
What was the goal then, just to make the businesses as successful as possible?
I've been really lucky in life and I became quite rich in 1983 and I wanted to give something back. And my dad died very young. So whenever we came up from Yorkshire, it just so happened coincidentally, Sunderland were playing at home. And I'd heard in the press, you shouldn't believe what's in the newspapers, but the boardroom trouble at Sunderland was over. So I wrote to Tom Cowie and asked him if there's any way I could meet him to see if I could help the club in some way. So he asked me to come to Sunderland to see him at Millbrook. And a couple of months later, he invited me to a game with my wife. We went and then a couple of weeks after that, if the result went okay, we'd get invited in the boardroom for a drink after the game. And then in 1984, in the June, he said he'd like me to sign a personal guarantee and join the board, which I did. And that was quite an amazing experience, because we were in what was the Premier League. To be the Premier League.
Yeah, first division, yeah.
The first division, yeah. And, that was quite an experience. So the first year we went to the League Cup final and got relegated. The next year he brought in Laurie McManamy.
Yeah.
And that was Tom's big move, because he always wanted a big name manager. You know, he tried for Brian Clough, Bobby Robson, and he finally got Laurie to leave Southampton to come up here. And of course, it was an unmitigated disaster. So in 1986, it was just about to start the season. And I think Tom had, at the end of the line then, I think he'd had enough. And he said to me, you've got two choices. You can either leave the club or you can come up here with a checkbook now and buy my shares. Yeah. And that was in August 86.
Just paint a picture as well of what was like at other clubs in the mid-80s. Were they locally owned by successful businessmen nationally?
There was everyone.
Yeah, so no overseas ownership or anything like that?
No ownership, nothing. You know, when in 86, you see, that was sweet because it was the opposite to when I went 2006. When I left, in 86, we knew all the players, the wives, the girlfriends, if they had a baby, they'd get a christening present. You know, I went to Marco Gabbiadini's wedding. That was the way we were. We were English, we were a club.
Like a family almost.
It was family. We, you know, somebody fell out with a girlfriend, we knew about it. You know, it was an English club, and it was really, really nice. You know, John McPhail's wife recently showed me a wedding present we'd got her. You know, it was just the way it was. It was, but football was at a low point then, Frankie. It was archaic. It was badly run.
Yeah.
The stadiums were bad. The hooliganism.
Yeah.
The whole thing was bad.
Well, come on, some of those points. Were you able to pick up the phone and speak to the owners of other clubs at that point for help and advice, or maybe just if you were going to play Manchester United next week or whatever, would you normally speak to the chairman in the run-up and then sit with them on the match day?
Well, I realised I haven't been to university about football. I played football but never got paid for it. So it's a new industry to me, and obviously very competitive, and I can't control it for 90 minutes. So I befriended Liverpool, and I went over to see their very eminent chairman, John Smith, and Peter Robinson, and I went to Glasgow Rangers to see Sir David Murray. And I just was insatiable for knowledge and friendship to make friends, because not 3 o'clock on a Saturday, but after that. So I really put myself into it. It was an enormous effort to try to learn and make connections and relationships.
Is it harder to be a chairman if you're a fan of the football club you're the chairman of?
I couldn't imagine being chairman of a club I wasn't a fan of.
So you're saying you have to have a bit of love there?
You can't do it.
Yeah. But nowadays, you know...
Well, they do it for money, don't they?
Yeah.
You're looking at corporate bodies.
Yeah.
You know, I couldn't do it. You know, obviously, we've got three clubs in the northeast. You couldn't get a better example. We've got Steve Gibson, who's irreplaceable.
Still there, doing a good job,
by all accounts. But he's irreplaceable. When Steve goes, that'll go, because there's nobody on Teesside with affluence or whatever to take his place. This here where we've got a really modern ownership, you know, and then we've got a state, a country, you know. So when you say you're a fan, is anybody up there fan? I don't know. I mean, it's too expensive.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but I imagine on those days where you said that yourself, you've got no control over the 90 minutes when the fans are frustrated, and they were frustrated for a period of time during your tenure as well. Are you going home with the same frustrations, thinking, "What, that new signing just hasn't worked? What is the manager doing?" And you're speaking to your wife about this on a Saturday evening. Are you the same? Are you just a fan?
Well, but Sue and I wouldn't speak for God, Pete.
Oh, really?
We'd do everything right, see the visitors away, make sure everything was okay, and leave, and we wouldn't speak. It was just too big of a thing. It's everything.
So you felt the relegation with Laurie McMenemy as much as the fans then, because you are a fan.
Yeah. I mean, I cut my teeth on my inheritance was Laurie McMenemy, because he had a contract we couldn't get rid of.
Mm.
You know, I had to pay him off when he agreed to a certain amount of money. I think I had Laurie from the beginning of the season till about March.
Yeah.
And then I brought Bob Stoke in, which was a lovely experience.
Yeah, a legend at the club, obviously. Yeah. The last 10 years, so much happened, really, you know, infrastructure-wise, Premier League status for a lot of them, the last 10 years of your tenure. I guess the infrastructure will be one of the main legacies you'll leave behind, obviously. Physical structures. You've got the Stadium of Light, the Academy of Light, and of course this building where we are recording this as well. Let's talk about the Stadium of Light first, because you inherited Roker Park. We then had Lord Justice Taylor recommend that all the top two divisions had to be seated stadiums, yeah, didn't they? So I'd imagine that became one of your main missions, I guess, was to change Roker Park, if it was feasibly possible, or then move to where we are now. Just tell us a little bit about that. I know it's all in the book, but for the fans listening, this report comes out and you know that Roker Park has to change, don't you?
Well, when I took the chair, I never thought I'd have to build another ground. And then, obviously, Heysel, Hillsborough, you know, happened in Bradford. And it was all waiting to happen, wasn't it? Neglect, uninvestment, no modern safety standards. It's just an example. I mean, we had a game at York that I was terrified about. I was really terrified we'd lose life at a game in New York City. So here we are with Lord Justice Taylor, who's a Newcastle man, but did a tremendous job, and it's law. You can't get a certificate if you don't have all-seater stadium. So we got a dispensation because they agreed that Roker Park wasn't changeable. We went in the first division with Dennis. We sold out twice at 23,000. And when we had the job done, about all seated came to 14,000. And that wasn't good enough, was it? So it was cost millions to do that. And we had a four-ended ground. We had the clock stand wood facing a terraced house. We had a crumbling concrete end, a grass mound, earth mound, and a very famous Archibald Leash stand.
Yeah.
That's what we had.
Yeah.
And there was no way. It was a no-brainer.
But you did investigate that, didn't you?
Oh, we went through
and it. I read in your book as well, there's a young George Clark was actually one of the architects who
helped. When we came back from the court case in London, we had to then open the ground, and we had to spend £1 million before the start of the season to get a safety licence by changing aisles and reducing the capacity, and the 16-year-old George Clark turned up from an architect in Washington.
So then you knew you had to find space for this new stadium for the people of Sunderland. Near the site of Nissan was the first place, wasn't it?
It was a great site if you wanted out of town. And it was the Wembley of the North, and it was all funded by Europe. There was MEP at the time, a guy called Alan Donnelly. And we used to go to Brussels quite often, and it was European money. That was what was going to do that. And then Nissan overnight went hostile because of their just-in-time deliveries. They rang number 10. They had a direct line into number 10. Nissan was that important. You know, they don't mess about.
It still is very important to the region.
Absolutely.
As well.
You know, and I'm not against Nissan. I made them shareholders of the club when I took the chair. And I got on very well with the chief exec, but they went hostile overnight. So I was left here with the Taylor report at one hand, nowhere to go. And so I said to eminent people in the Northeast, you know, what do you want to do with your football club?
Yeah.
What do you want to do with your football club? And the chairman of Vokes at the time, Sir Paul Nicholson, was also chairman of the Tyneway Development Corporation. And they had a very good chief executive called Alistair Balls, a Scotsman. And they undertook on the sales to explore Monk Weirmouth, which was closed. And I did a deal with the Tyneway Development Corporation where they prepared the land. And we put this magnificent stadium on it.
Isn't there something quite romantic and full circle once again that your father worked down the pit at Silkswith? The Sunderland, you know, the stadium is built on, it's literally built on the heritage of the city, isn't it?
It is, yeah. And it's close to the city. I think it's a great location. Everybody can see it every day.
Yeah, it's fantastic. And one of the things I've experienced while doing SAFC Unfiltered for the football club is speaking to a lot of the players, Sir Bob. And when I ask them about what made them come to the football club, they say, well, I had a look around the stadium. It's very nice, big. It was impressive. There was no one in there, but there's something special about it. And then I went to the Academy of Light, and it's as good as anywhere I've ever been. Yeah. How important was it that you May that happen as well.
Well, obviously, when I came to the club, it had no infrastructure, it had no youth system, it didn't have any scouting system, it didn't have any medical, it just had nothing. And we had a field at Cleeden.
The Charlie Hurley Centre?
Yeah. Well, no, before that.
Before that?
It was a field on the roadside. And it we had a field with two goalposts, no trees, no water.
So the lads would have to go to the Roker Park for a shower?
Yeah, go to Roker Park, get changed, drive down there, get muddy, they sit in their own cars, come back and go in the bath. So match day was no special occasion.
No.
That's where they were training.
Right.
So they had nothing. The Charlie Hurley I bought the Charlie Hurley for the club. It was Bartram Sports Ground.
Okay.
And that was it.
So that was a step up?
It was a step up. We had porta cabins and a nice surface. And countryside and privacy, that was a step up. But the academy, John Ficklin, has to take a lot of credit for the operational side of it. What we did with the Charlie Hurley, we did a deal with Sky. I chose them as our media partner. Man City did theirs. They looked, we're a Premiership club. They were looking for clubs to be permanent. And what they did is they bought equity for 5% of the new shares. We issued new shares. And they give us 12 or 13 million pounds for these shares. And the company got the money. And that started the Academy Light, because we'd bought the farm, you see. The Holmes family, a very intimate family, had a dairy and a yoghurt thing there. But they decided not to continue it. So we bought the whole farm. And we did that, but it works beautifully. Mm-hmm. You know, the seniors are at one, the sunk underneath, the presser at one side. We actually went to see Arsenal as well. We learned a lot from Arsenal, but we took it a step further because we put mounds there and wind protections, and the pitch is the same as the Stadium Light. And
did you learn from anecdotal responses that if you looked after the players, you would get better players and better performances?
It's common sense, isn't it?
Yeah.
You know, like, if you know, it's common sense.
Yeah.
I think we obviously got the stadium, but we need an educational place, don't we? I think the Academy Light's a very special place.
Mm.
It's a really special place, so near the city as well.
Yeah.
And I was really disappointed when, even after I'd left, I'd worked with Niall to get a plan permission for a full-size pitch there,
mm-hmm.
indoor, because we've got one at St George's.
Mm-hmm.
And Ellis Shaw just put a quarter one down,
mm-hmm.
which I think was really retro step. So we've got the basic size down there, but you could have put a full door down because we actually got a plan permission for it.
But it has got pretty much everything else down there,
yeah,
hasn't it? And
got,
it's really well respected.
Yeah,
and,
it's
yeah,
yeah. It even makes it more why you would fail as a club when you've got that facility.
And it's funny because the public don't really get to see it, do they? Really?
No, they don't.
So it's more about
place.
In the industry.
Yeah, but it is top notch. You know, there's people come on and gone a bit further, like Man City, since then. But at the time, it was the best.
Yeah, we can't have you on here without discussing the building which we're in right now, the Foundation of Light, Beacon of Light, a very imposing building which is right next to the Stadium of Light. And it's got a lot of importance, this building and the charity within it, hasn't it, Sir Bob? And it's all about inclusion, accessibility, and making the lives of people in Sunderland and Durham better, isn't it?
It is, yeah. I mean, I think, what do you think when you work for us, doesn't it?
I think it's you get the wow factor, don't you? You come in on the street level, as it's called, and you look up and think, wow, and then you think, oh, someone told me there's a football pitch on the top of this as well. So unless you come in and experience it.
It looks like a box, doesn't it?
It does look like a box, and I like it on a match day when it's red and white as well.
Yeah,
it's
well,
wonderful.
Like it. Yeah. So it is a wow factor. You hit the word. Everybody comes in that door and goes, wow. And 7,000 people a week come through it.
Yeah.
Plus we've got outreach centres.
Mm-hmm.
The trouble is it's needed.
Yeah,
it's needed more today. When I thought about this in 2010 with Leslie, I never thought we'd have people come in here to get warm.
Yeah.
I find it really bad.
Yeah, I mean, that's the situation we are in, I guess, because of the way that the state of play is in the country right now. And it's a very important cause and one of the reasons why I ran the Great North Run for the Foundation of Light this year.
Good.
You can thank me later for that. I'm still feeling the aches and pains of that, actually. But, yeah, it's a very important place. And to be situated so close next to the Stadium of Light as well, that's intentional.
Yeah, well, that's uplifting, isn't it?
Yeah.
And to have the crest.
Yeah.
You know, it's a life changer. We save lives here, Frankie. We turn lives around. It's like a hospital, but a good news hospital. It's a maternity ward. It brings good news.
Mm-hmm.
The vast number of times it changed people's lives. We've got 46 programmes living here.
Yeah.
It's inspiration, uplifting, and life-changing.
And there's accessibility for everyone here, and inclusion, isn't it? I mean, does that come from your upbringing and maybe the people you saw in concert when you were a small child and you thought you saw people who maybe didn't have an outlet or a route into employment or a route into education? People still get left behind right now, don't they?
I think most people just need a chance in life or a step up. You know, I was co-sponsor of Academy 360 at Pennywell, and I went up there last week to see the progress that's made, and it is coming on very good. You know, I'm a great believer in education. Education changed my life. So it's common sense, really. You know, it wasn't to get a knighthood. I had a knighthood before here, and it was, you know, the concept came in 2010. And it's a really small piece of land, so the architect was inspirational to come up with a building of this, like a street, on such a tiny piece of land. It was amazing, and the government gave me the land for £1.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that because it was such a good scheme.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it shouldn't be down a back street somewhere. It should be up proud, because people can walk in and they can do this and then to see that. And
literally anyone can walk in, can't they?
Yeah, there's no security system here.
Yeah, that's
great.
There's
no need, just walk in.
Open door policy.
Open door policy, yeah.
Yeah.
So it's good.
Let's bring things back to football, because you're a football fan. You're a Sunderland fan.
Yeah.
They're doing all right on the pitch at the moment, aren't they?
Yeah.
Exciting team to watch.
Very exciting. You know, I've really enjoyed it since Kirill's come through the door. It's been a really hard time for us fans since Niall went. Really, it's been a lost decade. We've had two really bad owners, and we've all suffered for it. You know, it's been really, really difficult for us on a number of fronts. I mean, the foundation have struggled with the ownership issues, and the fact, you know, the club didn't put one penny into this building. It's unthinkable, isn't it, through the owners at the time.
But Mr. Louis Dreyfus is on board with the projects you've got going on, and someone you speak to?
Yeah. Well, Kirill rang me before he took the club on. Somebody had mentioned he showed interest in Sunderland. So Kirill rang me to ask me certain things. And we were on the phone about an hour and a half.
Did you appreciate that?
Oh, yes. I mean, what a great start. That it's somebody said, before you go on to Sunderland, you need to speak to Bob Murray. And I thought, well, good on you. So Kirill's come in, and he's a trustee here. He gets it. He understands. He's a honorary owner of Sunderland Football Club for a certain limit of time. He's way beyond his years. I went to his wedding in Venice, me and Sue went, a three-day wedding. There was only four of us went, Christian and his wife, who's head of recruitment, and me and Sue. What a lovely family. They've got a history of football. He knows what he's doing. He's determined to succeed. Obviously, he's made a lot of appointments. Recruitment is excellent. I really enjoy this team. I look forward to them. I think they're a great set of young lads. They're very together. They're ambitious. They would play for each other.
Did they get you off your seat when you watched them?
They don't drop their heads.
Yeah.
They don't drop their heads. I mean, they're the perfect Sunderland team for me. Obviously, they're not Stefan Schwartz or Claudio Rain or Kevin Phillips, you know, but, you know, they'll do for me.
Yeah, they're very good. If things continue going the way they're going for Sunderland under Kirill Louis-Dreyfus, where do you think Sunderland will be in 10 years' time?
Well, you know, despite country zone and football clubs and all the problems the game get with, can you imagine that the Premier League chairman got the sack for Newcastle becoming a change of ownership? I mean, can you imagine that? Or whatever's going on. So we're on a journey here. I mean, can you imagine that certain clubs thought they could break away recently?
Yes.
I mean, it's unthinkable, isn't it?
Do you think that'll come again?
Well, they'll have a go because it's about money. One way or the other, they'll have a go. But I think it's the fact is, if you look at England, there's 22 clubs in the league. And if you look at football clubs, Sunderland will be in one of those 22.
Yeah, hopefully near the top end.
Well, they'll be in you can't really play against countries, but they will get back in the Premier League. I'm certain. It's just a matter of when. We're on a journey, and it's a nice journey.
And we should just finish by mentioning the book again. I Do It All Again. Yeah. It's out now, and all the proceeds go into the Foundation of Light. That's right, isn't it? So, Bob Murray, thank you very much.
Thank you, Frankie.
Well, that's it for this edition of SAFC Unfiltered. We'll be back next week, I believe, with another very special edition of SAFC Unfiltered. And Danny will be back as well. So until next time, we'll see you soon.